Before we begin, Simran and I want to acknowledge that we're recording this on the land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nations. We'd like to acknowledge and pay respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to any First Nations listeners.
Always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
Welcome back to Broadly Relevant.
I'm Simran Pasricha.
I'm Ryan Hamilton.
And this is the podcast for Bearcat girlies.
Trying to stay broadly relevant.
What have you been listening to this morning? You wanted to tell me about it.
Yeah, so I've been listening to Macklemore's 2005 album.
Okay, so real.
No, because, okay, so Macklemore put out like a pro-Palestine song.
Yes, King. Right?
And then the comments were like, this is so wild. Thrift Shop Guy is doing like social justice. There's a song called White Privilege where he's just analyzing his own positionality within the rap scene as a white rapper. And I was like,
that's wild. Yeah. That's so interesting. Look, I'm a podcast girly. I was listening to Found Objects, and it's a history podcast. And they were talking about Patty Hearst, who is a heiress turned terrorist. A very interesting story. I highly recommend.
Broadly News.
Felt good in person. I love that. So what's happening in the news?
There's a cost of living crisis. Have you heard about it?
What? Never. I was on, not to self-plug, but I was on Triple J Hack. Last week.
Ooh.
And we were talking about Gen Z nihilism and our spending habits. And I had to go to war to defend Gen Z spending habits and how we, like, you know, love a little treat because everything sucks anyway. So, like, we're going to, like, spend that, like, $8 on that matcha. And ever since then, I'm like, oh my God, why am I spending $8 on my matcha? It's actually craziness.
There's not been explicit news on this, but it's just been on my mind because I saw a play over the weekend, mm-hmm. which was talking about the issue of homelessness amongst women aged 55 plus.
Yeah.
Which is a massive issue, you know? Massive issue.
Should, like, I tell you how massive it is?
Yeah, well, the cohort's massively rising. There's something like 215,000 women over 55 at risk in Australia of becoming homeless.
The number of women over 55 experiencing homelessness in 2021, the 2021 census reported that it was 7,325 women. That's crazy.
Let's also note that actually that number is potentially lower than the actual number of people experiencing homelessness.
Yes.
Because during lockdown, the Victorian government was like, let's put all the homeless people, let's give them homes because it's probably bad if they're on the streets during a lockdown, and then kick them out afterwards.
Bizarre. Is that what's happening with the public housing? I saw that in our notes.
Well, no. Okay. So with the public housing, right, Labor is essentially, they were like, let's demolish all the public housing blocks.
Unhinged take. Okay, please explain more.
Absolutely insane. The take is essentially, they're like, yeah, we'll build more housing in their place. And, like, they are, you know, aging infrastructure, which you do have to look after.
Mm-hmm.
But their pitch is like, we'll demolish them and they won't even build the same amount of houses in their place. The same amount of public houses.
Yeah.
Because they'll sell some off to private developers. Anywho, it's fucked. So fuck the Labor government.
Yeah.
What's her name? Jacinta Ardern? No, that's not our premier's name.
That's New Zealand.
Jacinta.
Allen.
I knew it was a Jacinta A.
Yeah.
I love Jacinta A's.
So, not good in housing.
No, not good at all.
In other Australian news, Australia is going to be introducing porn passports. Yeah, you heard it right. Porn passports, which is such an interesting concept.
Let's go for a trip.
Yeah. Indeed. So the government is responding to a resurgence in gender-based violence and deaths in Australia, right? And they committed about like $1 billion within a range of different strategies to tackle this issue. And they find that tackling online harms was amongst like the new commitments. And they really think that basically underage exposure to adult content is considered to be a contributory, like it's considered to contribute to domestic violence, like through fueling harmful attitudes towards like relationships, especially like intimate relationships. And agreed. Totally agree with that. Basically, they're like, you have to come up with like some sort of like identification, basically, and that will be your passport for over 18 sites.
Yep.
Where this is an issue is, okay,
I'm anti this, if I may be so political.
No, that's like fair enough. I think the issue is that it's not going to work.
Well.
Because, you know, every kid is going to get around this, basically. And I really don't see a way it's going to work. I applaud them for, like, trying something, but Okay, what do you think?
Yeah. I think it's also like, you know, it's so purity culture. It's like, yes, I think pornography, especially like, you know, hardcore heterosexual pornography contributes to misogyny. But it's like the pornography is not the issue. The violent video games are not the issue. The issue is like how little support we actually give kids in school to teach them.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think this is the solution.
Mm-hmm.
I think it has severe privacy implications.
Yes.
Not to mention the fact that the problem with a lot of these systems is that the cost of verifying users, because they've been trying things like in the US, like it costs, you know, like a couple cents per user per verification, right? Which adds up because there's a lot of users doing it. And so what they've seen in like American states where they've implemented these is just pornography has died online because it's not affordable. Like it's not justifiable to do it in the, like to do it. So like Pornhub pulls out, you know, all the other sites pull out, which isn't necessarily bad, but sex work is real work, and a lot of people do get money from that. And so anything that, you know, ruins that industry is bad. That's my hot nuanced take.
True.
What's your insight?
Well, I think there's a difference between ruining an industry and regulating an industry. And I think this attempts to do that.
Yeah.
But it's not a very considered take, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
I wonder, because I don't think that people as young as like 14 or 15 should be seeing such violent porn, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I do think it creates really unhealthy
100%.
Yeah, relationship ideals. But you're right. I think that education really needs to be centered within this conversation. It can't just be one or the other.
Yeah. And I think the other like big risk is like, I don't want the government to keep a log of that.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's like, it's been a big conversation about like what that privacy looks like.
Yeah.
But I just like don't, I think that kids will just bypass this system,
so
you know?
Easily.
Sorry,
so
but like
easily.
Everybody was creating like Facebook accounts, not me. I was really, I wasn't allowed Facebook till I was 16. But you know, people are creating accounts at like 10 and like people do that
absolutely.
On TikTok as well. Like it's just, it's so easy to get around. And if it wasn't easy to get around, then it would also be a privacy issue. So
and,
I think.
Like I think the government's role in this discussion should be more active in like actually fueling a better culture rather than just say we're banning this and hoping that a better culture happens.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can take a more proactive approach and actually advocate and teach rather than just like we'll cut it off and the problem goes away, because actually the problem just goes deeper.
Yeah.
Then, you know?
Yeah. This isn't necessarily a ban, but it's definitely a band-aid, that's for sure.
On the topic
of
media, which is vaguely related. Guess
broadly.
Which famous media site got banned from Israel?
Which one?
Al Jazeera.
Oh, it got banned.
Yeah.
True.
So basically, like, anyone in Israel who, like, also, like, provides Al Jazeera information, that, like, that's a crime. Like, Al Jazeera just can't operate in Israel, which is such tea because Al Jazeera, if you don't know, is actually, like, really reputable and they're funded by the Qatari government. I'm going to fact check that one.
Oh, so we are coming into our fact-checking era, I think. Someone made fun of me the other day that we weren't a fact-checking podcast.
We, in fact, check some facts.
We do.
But I was right. So it's funded by the Qatari government. But the Qatari government, I watched a whole video essay on this, really slay because they are positioning themselves as kind of like the Switzerland of the Middle East.
Mm.
And part of that strategy has been heavily funding an Al Jazeera, which is critical of like even their own government, because the fact that they have the neutral, unbiased media organization for the Middle East headquartered there looks fucking great for them. And like the moral of the story is like, go fly Qatar Airways.
No free promos. Okay, please. Any other updates?
Well, you visited the encampment at Uni Melbourne on Monday,
didn't
you?
I sure did, yeah. The encampments around the world are really still going strong, and it's really amazing to see so many students be so committed to the fight to free Palestine.
Yeah.
I did visit the Melbourne encampment just the other day. We were able to feed them dinner. Like, we were able to cook them dinner, me and my housemates, and some people donated money for the groceries and things like that. So very, very grateful for that. The vibes were great, honestly. It was very calm, peaceful, loving.
Looked like a vibe on your story.
Oh, it was a vibe. There was like dances. And I think we mentioned this last episode as well. Like the cross-cultural exchange within art is really beautiful to see. And yeah, it's a very open environment, you know, like some people that were just like walking past the campus and, you know, like saw there was food. And so they were like, hey, can I have some food? And they were like, yeah, sure, no worries. And then from there, they were like, actually, I don't really know why you guys are like here. Can you explain it to me? And they're so open to talk about it, you know, like it's, I feel like the way that a lot of the media is like trying to portray it. And a lot of like the unis are trying to portray it, these encampments, is that they are, you know, causing a disturbance and, you know, are disturbing the peace and are like violent in some regards.
Yeah.
No, like, they're just dancing. There's a library. Like, it's a cute little spot on the quad that they're, like, sitting and hanging out and eating food and meeting new people in the community. And it's a beautiful thing. And it's a really great way to show solidarity with the people in Gaza. And if you're wondering how you can support these encampments, most of their Instagrams have like different lists of like what they're looking for. So like it might be like tents or like lights or torches or something like that. But you can also go and feed them like a meal, you know, and like prep dinner, lunch, breakfast, because it is getting cold. Okay. And yeah. It is in fact getting cold and it is getting harder to stay out there. So if you can bring them a warm meal, that would be amazing. And yeah, it's really great to see. Not just Melbourne Uni, RMIT has one now.
Monash has one.
Yeah.
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 Went down there and I was like, slay. Actually, Monash has had a couple like Zionists come out and disturb them overnight, which has been good.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's very...
Anywho, fuck Zionism, free Palestine.
Indeed.
We are a politically neutral podcast.
Huh?
This is the Al Jazeera of the indie podcast industry in Australia. Broadly culture.
That was fun.
It's been a big week for culture, I'd say.
It has.
We're going to talk about Met Gala. We're going to talk about Kendrick and Drake. We're going to talk about Eurovision. And we're going to start with...
Dua Lipa! We said the biggest, maybe the biggest week for pop culture, and we're going to go with Dua Lipa.
No, because that album, not a slay.
I know, and it's so, I feel bad. I feel bad whenever any artist goes into their flop era, because they put so much work into it.
No, I know, and I'm like, Radical Optimism, she nailed the name.
Yeah.
The album cover, nailed. Musically, the singles were great.
Yeah.
The singles were great. I was excited for a Dua resurgence.
Look, I have to say, a lot of her songs are starting to sound the same.
Yeah.
A little boppity bop, but, you know, in their floppity flop. But I think I know why. And by me, I mean TikTok. Because I was watching this creator called Bianca Stellina, aka Infinite BS on TikTok. And she talked about Dua Lipa not being as successful as an artist as her peers because she has no law. And essentially, it's because, like, her public persona is essentially, like, non-existent. And she was like, do you even know anything about, you know, like Dua's personal life? And I said, yeah, she dated Anwar Hadid, but that's about it. They've broken up now. But Bianca refers to an article in the LA Times titled Dua Lipa is a Pop Star with No Law on Radical Optimism by Mikhail Wood. And the article says, can a pop album succeed without functioning as a referendum on fame as a work of musicology? Is it enough just to deliver a bunch of loosely connected bangers and bops? And I don't know anymore. So to this, Bianca says, sure, you could argue that if Dua personally finds meaning in her songs, then that means that they do have meaning. But I don't think artists can assign principal value to the message in a piece of their art if their audience isn't able to sufficiently understand it. Which is such tea, because she's basically saying if we don't have context to the music, then it has to be really, really catchy. And she uses the example of like Sabrina Carpenter's Espresso, which is such a bop. And I think, you know, now we actually have a metric of how catchy a song is, and that's how well it does on TikTok. Which I agree with, but it also kind of makes me like sad and go back to the concept that we talk about a lot, is everything has to be content, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thoughts, feelings, emotions?
Well, when like Dua was like starting, I really didn't like her because like it felt so synthetic and artificial. And then my housemate was actually introducing me to K-pop. And I was like, interesting. Mm. And I think I draw a lot of parallels between K-pop and Dua Lipa particularly, because the way that K-pop is so synthetic and sort of like artificial, and I don't mean that in a bad way, like it's created and like very much like manufactured, I think is to me what Dua feels like. But then it's like she doesn't have the production values of K-pop, you know?
Sure.
She's not serving like the way BTS and Blackpink do. And I think that hinders her, you know? She's just like one diva, one British-Hungarian diva.
Yeah, well, I guess that, I thought she was Albanian.
I'm going to fact check.
She's definitely Albanian. Sorry, my Albanian queen.
You're so right.
Yeah, sorry. Well, that's the thing. I think that her songs are just simply not catchy enough compared to K-pop. I do have to say, though, that like in K-pop, each member has its own lore and like its own group of fans, you know?
And like... But I think the way that that lore is constructed is really synthetic, if
right.
that makes sense.
Okay,
like,
okay.
It's not like, you know, the way Chapel Roan feels really rough and raw at the edges. Like, everything is so, like, PR and polished, and mm-hmm. this is the story we're telling you. Dua, we've just never been told a story.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that hinders her.
Yeah, absolutely. It also gets me thinking about, like, how good is the art that we're actually consuming and, like, deeming
well,
good art, you know?
Yeah.
And it, all roads lead to Taylor Swift. They do.
They
Sorry,
do. No,
you know?
No, I could see her down the road.
Hey, but you know, like she has so much lore about her. We know so much about her personal life, and so we can relate it to her lyricism and her music. If it stood alone, would it be that good? Because a lot of people compare it to like Tumblr poetry, you know?
Absolutely, and I don't think it would be.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when I talk about Taylor's brilliant artistry, like, that's what I mean. Mm. Like, the way she's leveraging her life to achieve success in this art industry, that's brilliant. Even though I think the actual artifacts themselves, the songs on their own, especially TTPD, may not slay, it's this story and world that she's created that's really engaging.
Mm.
And Dua's world is...
Yep. Well, non-existent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, when she comes out with a banger, fuck, I love it.
Yeah.
And then there's nothing to keep me, you know?
It's kind of sad. I feel like you can't really have many boundaries then if you want to succeed in this way. Like, if you want fame, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I think you can set certain boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, Taylor, we've heard nothing about, like, sort of the professional side of her business.
True.
And I feel like that's, like, a, you know, nobody knows who River Payne is.
Yeah.
Is that her even name?
Tree Payne? River.
Nobody knows who Tree Payne is, right? Yeah. And there's that really interesting boundary. She, like, really turns her romantic life into art. But, like, you know, her family off limits. And you can set those boundaries, but, like, you know, yeah, the people want stories and Dua doesn't serve them.
Yeah. Indeed. Speaking of lore.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about Kendrick and Drake.
Okay, so I am absolutely not the most qualified person to talk about this. But from what I surmise from the TikToks I watched, Drake is a man into bad things. And Kendrick called him out publicly on multiple diss tracks. And then they had a bit of a fight. And Kendrick dropped a really great diss track, which was called Not Like Us. There's another one that's come out. Oh, God, it keeps going. Anywho, they're fighting. And Drake's like, I'm not a pedophile. And Kendrick is like,
yes, you are.
So that's really messy.
The boys are fighting.
The boys are fighting, and Kendrick's right. Anywho.
Kendrick calling out Drake's, like, little blue-eyed, blonde-haired son.
The one where he's like, you like A minor.
Yeah.
And A minor is the musical scale with no black keys in it. Yeah.
T.
On a piano.
Oh, yeah. Gotcha. TTT. I also love that J. Cole tried to, like, get up in this drama, and then Kendrick was like, no, this is just between me and Drake. Please stop.
Anywho, and then Macklemore dropped his track about Palestine, being like, why do we care about Drake?
No, literally.
And I'm like, no, that's a point.
Yeah, that is the point indeed.
So that's the tea. There's drama, but, you know, free Palestine.
Indeed. Speaking of free Palestine, what else is happening in Eurovision?
Well, Eurovision is happening, and this is a really complicated time for a lot of Australians because we are proud Eurovisioners.
Supposedly. Allegedly.
And Eurovision has not kicked Israel out.
Yeah.
So the broad vibe is boycott Eurovision,
mm-hmm.
which is so fair, and I don't disagree with that. Unfortunately, The Australian entry this year is Electric Fields, and they're one of my favourite bands. And they're this really great, like, electronic duo. The producer is white and the singer is Indigenous. And they sing in Pichanjara, Yakunchachara in English.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like, really boppy songs in language.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been fanging for them to go to Eurovision for like 3 years because they were on like Australia Eurovision Decides a couple years ago. And I was like, fuck, they need to go because, you know, they're going to slay. And I'm like, I hope they win. And I'm just shitty that this is the year they're going because like Montaigne was also in talks to go to Eurovision. And then apparently was told by SBS that if Montaigne went, they wouldn't be able to talk about Palestine. And then SBS ghosted Montaigne and Montaigne put out like a shady TikTok being like, how I feel knowing I can still talk about Palestine despite not going to Eurovision, being like, good. And I think it's really, you know, messy how I'm like, shit, there's this, you know, amazing artist which like represents, I think, what a reconciled Australia could look like.
Mm-hmm.
Next week is Reconciliation Week. And, of course, the year they're going is this year, and it's really fraught how it feels like liberation is caught up in the Israeli project.
Yeah.
Does it make sense?
It does make sense.
And I'm sad. Remember Madonna at Eurovision 2019 in Tel Aviv?
I can't say that I do.
Well, so Madonna was the interval act, and she was like, yeah, hundo. She gets up there doing an interval act in Tel Aviv at one point. Rips off her costume because, of course, it's a tearaway costume. She's wearing a Palestinian flag and she's on stage in Tel Aviv, streamed across Europe in Israel, right? And then she just keeps dancing the Palestinian flag. And, of course, it's Madonna.
Yeah.
What are you meant to do?
Yeah.
So that was a mess. And she, you know, left Israel quickly after. And there was another
act. She left, my God.
There was another act who, like, pulled out a Palestinian flag halfway through and they literally had to, like, run out of the stadium afterwards.
Wild.
Anywho, so fuck Zionism, free Palestine. I love Electric Fields. That's my point on Eurovision.
Boycott Eurovision.
But listen to Electric Fields.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so the winner of Eurovision in 2016 was named Jamala, and she was Ukrainian. And that was, of course, the year that the Crimea was invaded by Russia. So she did a song called 1944, which is a song about the Russian annexation of Crimea in 1944.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was like, no, it's not at all about what's happening this year. And it's like, that's brilliant political theater, you know, well done, Jamala. Really great song, really, really great song. So she won and it was in Ukraine and that was great. And she's come out in support of Eurovision this year because the EBU, the European Broadcasting Union, who produces Eurovision, as soon as Russia invaded Ukraine, blocked Russia from Eurovision. That makes sense. There's an active war, 100%, kick them out. And so Jamala was like, it's really important that we keep doing Eurovision to, like, resistance to Russia, like, show Russia that, I don't know, which is, like, a take I get, but I'm just like, there's an act of genocide.
That'll trust me.
Like, yeah. Actually, and I so hear you, Ukraine, there's an act of genocide.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's really fraught. And, yeah, maybe we should just kick Israel out of Eurovision.
T.
Possibly even the UN. I don't know.
What if we just...
It's an illegal state. Sorry, that was a deep dive.
No, I love your Eurovision deep dives. This is every year around this time. Yeah, every year around this time. Speaking of around this time, the Met Gala happened just yesterday.
Yes.
Did you have any fave looks?
Tyler with the sand dress.
Yeah, stunning, incredible. Stunning, incredible. Stunning. For context, the Met Gala's dress code, which is different from the theme,
mm-hmm.
The dress code was The Garden of Time, and it's based off a book called from J.G. Ballard, his name is. And it's about this count and countess who live in this beautiful villa, and there's, you know, it's described as a place of leisure, beauty, opulence, and it's just a gorgeous spot. But the thing about this villa is that when you look out into the view, you see a mob of angry commoners, and that's the word, okay? The angry commoners being like, oh my God, I hate you so much, like, what the heck? Eat the rich, you know, same. And the way that they keep these commoners at bay is by plucking glass roses from their gardens, which buys them a little bit of time. But the thing is, the glass roses are running out.
Non-renewable resource.
Yes, non-renewable resource. And that's something not enough people talk about, you know? This is actually about climate change. And essentially, one day, like, there's no more glasses. And then when the comment is, they storm the villa, they open up the villa, but they find that the villa is in ruins and that the Count and Countess have been turned into stone. And to this, I say, Miss Girl, Anna, are you a secret socialist?
No, and yeah.
It is so on the nose. It's actually, it's uncomfortable.
I kind of loved it.
Yeah.
I can't remember who was wearing it, but someone came with a purse, and the purse was a frozen bronze rose.
Yeah. Camila Cabello.
Yeah. Just a block of ice with a chain attached with a rose inside.
Yeah. Genius. And by the time that she went up the Met steps, it's like supposed to be melted essentially. Oh my God. It would have been so painful to like carry that. My God.
Well, she was using the chain, wasn't she?
No, she had to carry it like just with her hand. It was a clutch. Yeah. Very interesting dress code in the times. Okay, first let's go through our favorite looks, shall we?
Okay.
Okay, so you said Tyla.
Yeah.
Oh, incredible.
She was wearing like, it was sand because she was the Sands of Time. But it was like sand's hand.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Incredible. Even on the shoulder, it was amazing. She had to get picked up to go up the stairs. And that was my favorite thing ever. Mindy Kaling was actually my favorite dressed of the night. She was in Gaurav Gupta. Mm. Not to be mistaken by Iris Van Herpen, which everybody mistaken this dress.
I do love Iris.
I do love Iris, but give Gaurav his time. You know, my South Asian baddies really killed the game on the Met Gala stairs. Mona Patel was also my favorite. She's an Indian entrepreneur, and she was wearing Iris Van Herpen, and she had like the floating, like the moving butterflies on her arms, and I thought that was incredible.
Yes, I saw that. That was stunning.
Alia Bhatt in a Sabyasachi sari was incredible. So regal, so beautiful. My Nepo baby slayed.
I really liked Kendall Jenner. So the dress was like, it was a nice dress, but the story behind it was really interesting. So it's archival Givenchy, and it had never been worn. Like they made it 25 years ago and never worn it.
Yeah.
Which ties into the broader like theme of the Met exhibition, which was Sleeping Beauty's Fashion Reawakened or whatever. She reawakened a girl. I loved the deep fake Rihanna dress.
Loved all of the deep fakes. Why were they so much better?
Did you see Katy Perry's mom texted her being like, oh my God, you went to the Met? And she was like, no, that's AI.
That's so funny.
But it was a great dress.
No, absolutely.
Cheers to ChatGPT.
Yeah. ChatGPT does it all. So my prediction was wrong. Well, maybe it's right, actually. I said that I predicted Rihanna would be really late to the Met Gala, and she was. She never came.
Still hasn't came.
Yeah. I'm really glad that Zendaya had two outfits, because the first one I loved, but it was a little bit underwhelming.
Yeah.
But she had two, and so I was happy about that. Chris Hemsworth, one of the hosts of the Met Gala, just came in a beige suit.
Oh, he was boring.
Oh, we're not in Byron anymore.
Anna Wintour wore Loewe.
Yeah.
Which is new because she used to always exclusively wear Chanel because of Lagerfeld. But she was wearing Loewe.
But he's dead now.
He's dead now. And I'm just like, I love Jonathan Anderson having his moment. Like, get your tea, you know? She still looked like Anna Wintour, but she was wearing Loewe.
Yeah, her getting a haircut every day is so wild.
What?
Yeah, every single day she gets a haircut.
No, that's insane.
Yeah, no, it is insane.
Can we talk about Tom Brown, who is a designer who consistently flummoxes me?
Like, yes.
I love him.
Yes.
Cynthia Erivo in this fucking, like, you know, blazer top, flowy rose petal dress.
Incredible.
Stunning.
And, like, she was, like, saying that it was, like, the decaying of flowers, like, coming off of her. And I was like, that's amazing. Other crazy things that happened at the Met Gala, Sabrina Carpenter showing us her real skin color. Was crazy. Insanity. Those are our loves and hates of the Met Gala looks. But interestingly enough, they really said, let's go all the way with the theme, because during the Met Gala, during like the steps, there was a protest, rightfully so, for Free Palestine outside the Met Gala steps. And all eyes should have been on Rafah that night.
Yeah, because Israel, of course, coordinates their attacks on the Gaza Strip to big events in American culture, like the Super Bowl and the Met Gala.
And now all citizens from Rafah have been forced to evacuate.
Where?
And where? No place is safe now in Gaza. And that is incredibly, incredibly on the nose with this theme. And it's disgusting, honestly. It feels really, really icky and disgusting and weird.
Did you know, when eating people, the only part of another person that you should never eat is the brain?
How come?
Because there's, so there's prions in the brain that will, like, you'll get, like, a disease if you eat a human brain.
Oh.
I know, but you can eat the rest of them.
Everyone note that down.
Just for the revolution.
Now, allegedly. Okay, moving on.
Broadly Diva.
Yeah, that's right. It's a different section today. We are introducing our brand new segment called Broadly Diva, where both of us bring forward a diva each and fight to the death who the ultimate diva is. Do you want to explain what a diva is?
So a diva is an inspiration, a personal inspiration. They could be a woman. They could not be a woman. They could be an object.
A concept? A feeling?
A sentiment.
Ooh. My diva of the week is my primary school art teacher. Her name is Miss Muscat.
Oh my God, I know her.
Yes. So she was, me right now seeing my notes, she was an art school teacher. Like, think, you know, really cool short haircut. Like, think, like, really cool clothes. Like, so many buttons. Like, so many buttons.
Yeah.
I'm seeing, like, a mix between the magic school bus teacher, Miss Frizzle, her name is, meets I Dream of Jeannie. That was her aesthetic, and I loved her for it. I said, oh, so she's a fashion icon.
I watched a deep dive on Miss Frizzle because they're basically like, why do all these children not want anyone to know about the magic school bus?
Oh.
And it was basically into this conspiracy. And the conspiracy was alleging that Miss Frizzle was like threatening all the children not to tell anyone.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, that is wild.
That's crazy.
That makes sense.
Okay, me reviewing Miss Muscat then. Okay. Anyway, she's still my diva. Okay. So, in fact, she was so cool because she knew if you were a little shit and she let you know that you were being a shit. And I really enjoy teachers that call you out on your bullshit. So grade six me, if I was being a little shit, I really enjoyed being called out. Don't know if that's like a shame kink or whatever, but here for that. And that's where it started. I also remember this moment where I was making an art piece with foil, okay? And it was to do with, hear me out. It was to do with, like, saving the world, climate change, or whatever.
Yep.
And so you had to, like, do, like, a cover page about this, like, segment for the semester. And so I used tin foil and, like, recycled tin foil to make out the letters. And I was very excited about this. But I got bullied about it by the girl sitting next to me, Boston. And she was like, oh, you're so weird. And I was like, I'm literally going to slap you in the face, but I'm not in Malaysia anymore. Okay. So, but Miss Muscat came over and she was like, oh my gosh, this is so bold and creative. And then she picked it up and she put it to the rest of the class and she said, this is the best in the class. And I said, hey, I love you so much. You have changed my life forever. The second point of diva-ism was when I spilled hot glue, like a hot glue gun, on my knee and she laughed at me. She laughed at me and in that moment, I hated that. But now I know that she was a sick cunt for doing that, to be honest. And that's all I have to say for that. Also, she was head of primary school art, right? And so there was a guy that was head of secondary school art. And he was kind of very annoying, right? And she agreed. And so I would go in my lunch times in like the art area to go chat with her. And she was like, don't even worry about him. Like, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Like, he's so annoying. And I was really, I loved that.
Gabbing with a teacher.
No, it's so important. And I love
serving a little yap.
Yeah, serving a little yap, serving a little gossip. And that's when I learned how gossip saved lives. So, gossip saved my life. Yeah. So that is why Miss Muscat is my diva of the week.
Two out of my four potential divas were, in fact, also former teachers. Ooh. And then I was like, Simran's done the former teacher thing.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go further. And so my diva of the week is none other than Jane Jacobs. If you've studied urban planning, this is a basic and tepid take.
Yeah.
But both of us have not studied urban planning, so it's going to sound edgy that I have this diva.
Ooh, okay.
She was a white woman, let's contextualize, living in New York in like the 40s to 80s.
Mm.
somewhere in there. Don't know. But essentially, she was an urban planner and like an advocate for urbanism and like a thinker about how we live in cities, right? She wrote the incredibly important book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities.
Right.
And basically her story is, and it was adapted into an opera. So there you go. She lived in New York. And there was this massive cunt at the time who was like a political guy and like, you know, extortion, bribery, etc. Bad guy. His name was Richard Moses. And at some point he ended up as the head of like urban planning in New York. And he was a racist dickhead. And so what he was doing was like trying to like build this future America, which, you know, was suburban and had highways everywhere. And so he was like dropping all these highways on New York. And of course, the massive problem with highways in American history is where did they build them?
Where?
Right over black and poor neighborhoods.
Every time.
Just like, you know, took their houses, chopped the neighborhoods in half, built a freeway, you know, and contributed to the massive inequalities that we continue to see because, you know, there was no public transport planning. You know, these people don't have mobility. It's harder to get better jobs. It's harder, like, you know, you're reinforcing social inequity. And so he was doing all these like explicitly racist things, like explicitly choosing the highways to go through like underprivileged neighborhoods because, you know, he doesn't want to fuck with his white electorate. Mm-hmm. Anywho, Jane Jacobs was intensely critical of this. And she wrote this book, which talks about a different way of urban planning, which focuses on the neighborhood and the street and sort of the way that community, which emerges from these like medium density suburbs, is, you know, the optimum form of like city living. Because, you know, in a well-connected mid-density neighborhood, everyone's like constantly paying attention to the streets. You know, people are looking out their windows. There's like shopkeepers. You know enough people around that you can like let your kids play on the street and it'll probably be fine. Mm-hmm. And it's this really interesting book which basically reconfigures the notions of urbanism that we were having at the time. Because there are people like this asshole French guy, like Le Corbusier. Mm-hmm. Said that wrong, don't care. He advocated for a really top-down model of urbanism where he was like, we'll just destroy it all and build giant parks with high-rises. And it's mm-hmm. like, no. Like, why can't we just live above shops and, like, have a cute little life? And Jane really advocated for that and advocated about against Robert Moses. And, yeah, I love her. So she's my diva of the week for advocating for better cities for us all and for advocating for us to live in community.
Well, you know what? Fuck you with that, okay? Obviously your diva's going to win then. My diva made fun of me for banning myself and your diva was saving the world.
And she had an opera written about her. It was literally like the battle between her and Robert Moses.
Don't worry, Miss Muscat, I'll write an opera for you.
I love her so much.
Yeah, I'm sure you do, and now I do too, Jane Jacobs.
Yeah.
Even your name's cool.
That's my diva. That's your diva. Should we do a vote?
Okay.
Okay. Just say I for Miss Muscat.
Okay.
And say I for Jane Jacobs.
Aye.
Jane Jacobs, winning diva of the week.
But that's just this week, Miss Muscat. Don't worry, you're a diva in my heart always.
Oh, hey, Simon, I have a checkout question for you.
Tell me.
What's your favorite movie snack?
I recently went to the movies.
Oh, my God.
I saw a double feature of Challengers and then Monkey Man. My movie snack is usually popcorn, and then I'll do Maltesers, and I'll mix it through, and then it's, like, salty and sweet all at once, and it's a beautiful time. The chocolate kind of, like, melts a little bit onto the popcorn, and it's a stunning time.
Okay.
Yeah, this time around, so I go get my, like, snack. I'm like, hey, can I get this? And they're like, I'm so sorry. We don't have any Maltesers. Okay, a little panic in me. That's fine. It's okay. We're going to move through it. We're going to move past it. They say, but you know what you could do? I could give you Skittles instead. And I said, how dare you? What about you?
Mine is popcorn.
Great. As long as it's not Skittles. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, we'd love if you could tell a friend.
Okay, bye. Love you.
Okay, bye. Love you.